Could we go on from Burma on to Western Europe now? And could you tell me about your experiences there, please?
Yes, I think I mentioned that I'd broken my Achilles tendon playing soccer against the Chinese, and it didn't heal up in India, and so they suggested I should go and see Sir Rowley Bristow, who's the expert and on that type of thing. So I was sent home to Britain, and I spent some time under him in hospital, and then, with the aid of an appliance, it got well.
When would this have been that you were in hospital?
This would have been October, November 1944. And then I was given sort of three choices. I was offered three types of jobs. One was to command a regular commando. The second one was to be in charge of SOE on MacArthur's headquarters in the Philippines, in Manila, which was a great attraction. And the third was to command the Special Air Service. I had a short time to try and find out what these different forces did. I knew about the SOE, and I decided that I thought that the war would go on for two or three more years in the Far East, and I thought that I should get some opportunity to learn about European warfare before going out to the Far East, and so I decided that the best thing would be to command the SAS. Now, the SAS at that time was quite a large organization. It consisted of two British regiments, the 1st and 2nd SAS, two French battalions, the Deuxième, Troisième Chasseurs Alpins Parachutistes, and a Belgian battalion under Colonel, a Belgian-Canadian colonel called Blondel, Blondel, plus a very big signals organization in Halstead, Essex, Halstead, allied to a Phantom section, which had been raised, I think, by Montgomery. They had all operated in Normandy and right up to the borders of France and Germany and into Belgium from some months before the invasion to the end, with varying successes, but on the whole did a very good job. The signal side was terrific, and I could, from my desk, send messages through the BBC, either in code or clear, to anybody of the SAS in the field. I very rarely used this. The person to whom I owed this organization, and it was a very, very good one, and with some very good staff, was Roddy General, or later became, he was Brigadier Roddy MacLeod, MacLeod. Later he became a Major General MacLeod, and He was head of ops in India, and he became a full general. And he was a very fine man. He was a gunner. He himself dropped into France a number of times and was flown out again. But he never broadcast this, and the old members of the SAS didn't really like him. They all said he was a staff officer, but he produced a very, very good organization, and which resulted in giving them some excellent support. He has been left out of the reckoning, and yet he was probably as responsible for the success of the SAS and for in France and Belgium than anybody. For the colonels of the SAS, Colonel Paddy Maine, who got four DSOs, and Brown. I'll come back to his name in a moment. Just Brown Franks. They, of course, could command their regiments when they were out of action, but in action, all they could do was to be just a patrol leader. So they, neither of them had any experience in command as a whole. Later on, especially by the Irish broadcasting companies, I've been asked, why wasn't Paddy Maine put in command of the SAS? Well, the answer was, he had never, throughout his very distinguished career, commanded anything more than about 12 men in action. And he had no idea of what was going on in the rest of the army. And he was brilliantly brave and very, very conscientious in planning. And he could foresee an operation in his mind. And so he usually brought it to a complete success without any casualties, or with very few casualties. The result is he had a great following amongst his officers and men in the SAS, and he was a great example. But he possibly could have been a commander if he had been taught how to do it or been given some opportunities. Brown Franks was a different cup of tea. The second SAS, first SAS, were rather like a rugby team, a successful rugby team. They were tremendously enthusiastic, and they went ahead and were willing to suffer discomforts, and they lived a fairly Spartan life. Brown Franks organized his much more on the, might say, the household cavalry, just as brave, but with a finesse, and he ran his mess very, very correctly, and he had a fairly large number of titled people in the second SAS, and with contacts at all the high levels in the British Army. And he used these contacts very often to obtain things or to change, even to change his orders rather unscrupulously. But he had vision. He was a very good manager of the Kensington Palace Hotel in peacetime, and he was a very good organizer. I only have one thing against him. When I gave him his orders to operate with Second Army, he immediately went to see General Dempsey and got his orders changed, because he didn't think I knew what I was doing, but there it is, that's only just one of those things that occur. In forces of this nature, one must expect that.
What kind of response did you get from Dempsey?
Oh, Dempsey immediately, he didn't refer it to me, and he changed his orders. This is, I'm afraid, one of those things. If you're going to deal with paramilitary warfare, you have to... these are the... There's a sort of ground you operate in. I'd like to make that clear. I may have done so earlier. This is, of course, a truism, possibly in all armies, that soldiers shouldn't get mixed up in politics. But guerrilla warfare and counterinsurgency warfare is a form of political warfare. It's closely allied to political warfare, and politics are endemic right the way throughout it. If, for instance, in the army, you're taught certain methods of doing things, and which, on the whole, you must follow. You are given rein to take initiative, but taking the initiative can bring a heap of recrimination onto you. Whereas in this type of warfare, really, you are working on not on orders, but on, I forget the word, you're working not on orders, but on directives, because the person who is in a position to give you orders doesn't know what the conditions are at the other end and in time.
So what exactly is the difference between an order and a directive?
Well, an order might say you will blow so-and-so and so-and-so bridge on the 15th of July. A directive would be said you will interrupt the communications on such and such a road or communications to a particular division or army between certain limits, and you will make two major destructions per month. Something like that. The chap on the spot can decide what's the best answer and when to do it. He has time to reconnoiter. He asks this, that, and the other. He knows might be by moonlight or by when there isn't any moon. And you cannot tell from a distance as to what the situation is. And so that is more the directive. It's the same to submarine warfare. You don't give orders to blow up a particular ship. They are to intercept enemy ships at a particular area. And that is, it's very like submarine warfare. And when once General Harding, I asked General Harding what he thought of Makarios. He said he was didn't like him. He's a very devious personality. So I said to him, what do you expect of a good guerrilla warfare? Head of guerrilla warfare has got to be devious. He's got to show every wile and guile there is. And in fact, I said when I did my research into guerrilla warfare, I said that the difficulty of a guerrilla leader is that he must show the good characteristics, good male characteristics, in order to get a following. That's of a sort of machismo. He must show bravery, he must have done certain military things in his life, brave things, to get a following, yet his actual tactics and strategy are those which we would call feminine. They are through wile and guile, because it's the weak against the strong. He must attack when his enemy is weakest. He must learn about his enemy. He must use the enemy's strength to destroy his enemy, and everything of that nature. And it's rather like the normal married life between a lady who wants to achieve her ends and her strong-willed husband. But that, and I have said that at a lecture at Oxford University, at their defense, they got a defense society, and it went down very well. They understood it immediately. I didn't have to go on explaining it. You have to be devious. Another thing I told all the SAS is they must be unpredictable. You must always be unpredictable. I think I learnt this from General Wingate. You must never do the same thing twice. You must not get into a pattern, and otherwise your opponent can judge what you're going to do and then ambush you or something like it. You must never, if you go out on patrol, you may never come back on the same route as you went. And this had an amusing sequel. After the war, the SAS had a ball, and I saw for the first time most of them were unmarried, their girlfriends and possibly their wives. And these wives and girlfriends descended on me and said, "You're the man who has taught my husband or engaged, etc., to be unpredictable." He said, "Every time he doesn't turn up or turns up late or does this, that, and the other," he says, "that's what he was taught by the brigadier, to be unpredictable." They were quite serious about it, and I had to undergo quite a barrage of questions. I was rather interested in this because I had lectured these people, and they weren't a very receptive audience. None of them knew who I was. They didn't know anything about the war in Burma. They saw my medals, so they knew I'd had some seen active service and some characteristics. But I was a complete unknown. They had all been betting on who would be their next commander, and I was something straight out of the bag. And I had great difficulty winning them over. And I did. I will say that that the regimental commanders were very, very, after a short while, were very, very loyal. And so gradually we got them over. I used to see them all. But I come back to when I first joined. The senior officers I saw who interviewed me were General Crawford, Director of Air, who was a sapper officer, amongst other things. I thought a very brilliantly clever chap. And the other was General Bourne, Bourne, who had one arm and who was a great parachutist and who commanded a parachute brigade and later became the Supremo in Malaya and other things. He had a great career. They're both strong characters, and they explained to me that the SAS had done very well in Normandy, but now it had long passed Normandy and France, and they were rather lounging about. They were to be seen in the West End bars and the Ritz and the Barclay Hotel every day and night, and also on all the race courses in their uniform with their medals up and with SAS on it. And this had caused adverse comment. Britain was saying to the Americans that we couldn't produce any more troops, and yet there were all these young, obviously good soldiers, officers and men being seen in West End of London. And I found, when I asked to see the officers and so on, there were always some missing because Some had gone to the races or something of that nature. So I had the orders that I must get them all into action within 6 weeks, and which I did. The first and second SAS, I got them overseas into the second SAS with second Army, and the first SAS with the Canadian Army. We had these armored jeeps, which were a wonderful invention. They'd really been sort of redesigned by a aircraft designer in lightness, etc. And there was my DA and QMG, a Major Caldwell, later he became engineer-in-chief. He was come from a long line of Royal Engineers, and he had a very inventive mind. And with that combination, they made the armored jeep. Now I can rattle through some of its characteristics. It had bulletproof windscreens, a Vickers machine gun on the in the passenger seat, a twin Vickers on a Motley Mountain with the windscreen acting as a shield, and Kurt Oates could swivel in any direction. The driver had a single Vickers on his side, which he could use in an emergency. It was there was armor over the radiator, and had run flat tires, and a self-sealing petrol tank, self-sealing jerry cans, and in the rear passenger had either twin Vickers or a 0.5 Browning on a Motley mounting, which could go in any direction he liked. They wore flak suits, and some of the jeeps had trailers in which they could put all their equipment and reserve ammunition. Later, when they came across some of these Tiger tanks, I experimented with putting, I forget the name of them, some rockets, powered weapons on them, so they could actually rocket the tank. They were very, very mobile, and they could go almost anywhere, and these officers and men knew how to use them, because they'd used them in the desert, and they'd used them in Normandy, and Roy Farron, amongst others, who were one of the most brilliant ones, had used them in Italy. I ought to say that the one unit I didn't have under close command was Roy Farron in Italy, where he was doing a very fine job. And so they were of great value to the Second Army and the Canadians, if either of those two forces knew how to use them. The snag is about a unit. Its staff and everything else of the army in which they operate must know how to use them, and the colonel, like a CRE or CRA, should be the advisor to the army commander as to how they're best used. Well, those two operated very well, and Paddy Maine won his fourth DSO operating with the Canadians. Then there was a question of the two French battalions. There had been a lot of complaints about them. They were living near Colchester, and the men used to go out and shoot pheasants with 303 ammunition, and they used explosives to trap hares and this, that, and the other. They were a bit wild. I got complaints through a lord, somebody or other, who had been Speaker of the House of Commons, and he was raising questions in Parliament about them. I went and saw them. There was the French were under a liaison group under a colonel whom I give you the name later on, whom I never did get on well with. He had been with Long Range Desert Group, rather supercilious chap. I think he'd been very efficient there, but the job of Long Range Desert Group, as with intelligence organization, is to see and not be seen, to report back what you see and not to take action on it. And he was, I think, very good at that, but he was, in my opinion, impotent. He would not take action. He'd never taken any action in his life on anything. And he lived a rather sort of exalted life, surrounded by his liaison officers, some of whom were very good. Well, I short-circuited them and went down to see the French, and I had given orders, direct orders, that all ammunition must be properly labelled and guarded and put in a guard room, and I went down there and I found all the ammunition just lying loose in a shed. And I was very angry, so I locked up their excellent colonel, second in command, their adjutant, the quartermaster, and a few others in this shed and told them to count the ammunition and to have it properly sorted out. I waited there all day until it was done. I thought this would probably be the end of me, but I insisted that every single thing was correct, and it was done very well. Colonel Bouladier, Bouladierre, had been in the French Foreign Legion, and he understood hard orders. And when I finally, at the end of the day, came and inspected them, that every single round of ammunition had been polished and numbered and everything else of that nature. And instead of my authority having gone down, it shot up. And we got the two French battalions under control. They were terrific fighters, as it turned out. But they had been recruited here, there, and everywhere. Some of them were different nationalities. Some French Foreign Legion, ex-civilians, and so on. A great mixture. And some very fine regular officers amongst them.